From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, if everyone is a journalist now, then at least one professor of journalism thinks we should all be subject to the same set of ethics. Then why trying to define the quirky, compelling films of Wes Anderson is kind of beside the point.
You know, he said, oh, yeah, Wes Anderson, he's a fill-in-the-blank. Well, what is he exactly? There isn't a label for what he does. I think that's a great thing, and I suspect that many other people find that refreshing also.
And Scott Russell Sanders has taught young writers for years with one key lesson at the heart.
The kind of writing I enjoy reading and the kind of writing I encourage my students to do is writing where you're actually discovering things about your experience, about the world, about language, about reality.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Most of what you listen to on this radio station constitutes journalism. There are different forms. Morning Edition is different from Lake Effect, which is different from Here and Now. But at the heart of what we all do as reporters and producers is a set of ethics. Those ethics include what we provide our listeners and how we treat other journalists and media outlets. But do you think of yourself as a journalist? Kelly McBride argues it's time for all of us to start thinking of media ethics, whether we're hosting a radio show or posting a video to YouTube. McBride is a senior faculty member in ethics, reporting, and writing at the Poynter Institute, a training and education center for journalists in Florida. She's one of the nation's leading voices on media ethics issues. McBride was in Milwaukee at the end of February to talk about ethics for an audience at Marquette University, and before that, she spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about how the sheer number of journalists in the 21st century affects the nature of media ethics.
I think there's something fundamentally different. We are living in a world now where the consumers of information are also creators of information. So it's not just that some of us can be journalists. We can all be journalists. And the thing about that is it means that the audience changes its ideas about what it finds valuable. So, I mean, and this is just one little example. It used to be that independence was really valuable to the audience, independence in the voice of the information provider. And that's because there were so few information providers. In any given city, there was a couple of newspapers and maybe a radio station and then later on television. But really, you could count them on one hand in most cities. And so in that case, when you only had five reliable sources of information, you wanted those sources to be neutral. You wanted them to be independent because if they weren't, they were likely to skew the way democracy worked. Well, these days, you have millions of sources of information. And so independence isn't nearly as important to the audience as it used to be. Now, transparency is way more important. People aren't necessarily concerned if you have a dog in the fight or if you're taking sides, but they want to know that information ahead of time.
Does that change what the ethics are, or does it change what the questions about the ethics are? I mean, I guess do ethics exist in a vacuum, or are they determined by the consumers of this stuff?
Well, I mean, I think you're talking about two sides of the same coin here, really. Because journalism is an unlicensed profession, we don't determine our ethics in some ivory tower and then impose them on everybody who holds the license the way accountants and doctors and lawyers do. Instead, we look to see what the audience finds useful, and we try and articulate those best practices and import them back into the practitioners. So it's really a ground up system of ethics. And let me say, there's another factor here, and that's the business concerns. Because the business concerns determine our ethics almost as much as the audience does. And even for that independence example that I just used, it was mutually beneficial to the business side of journalism to be independent. If you could aggregate a wide audience, then you could sell that audience to an advertiser. Now that the economic models are crumbling in journalism, that's another pressure that's changing our ethical considerations.
So this is the idea that there are some advertisers who would seek to be associated with an outlet that has a particular bent one way or the other.
Right. I mean, that was one idea. But the reality is now that advertising just isn't working the same way it used to. Advertising is no longer looking for the widest possible audience. They're looking for the most engaged audience. And that means different things to different advertisers. It means different things on different platforms. And so the changes in the economic model, that's changing how we describe our mission as journalists as much as the technological changes in the audience habits changing as well.
Are there things about ethics that haven't changed? Are there fundamental parts of what it is to be a journalist that really are exactly the same in 2014 as they were in 1914?
Well, sure. Let's start with telling the truth, right? Like, that's pretty important. That was always part of the fundamental ethical principles of every journalism code that I've ever seen, those that I've participated in writing. And that tends to be the first principle always, always, always. Seek the truth and report it as fully as possible. That's one way of articulating it. Tell the truth. And to the extent that we can find these other pressures causing journalism organizations to not tell the truth or to distort the truth, I'm very comfortable saying, you know what, that's unethical. When your business pressures cause you to distort the truth, when your desire to please the audience causes you to distort the truth, or when your conception of fairness or equivalency so this actually happens all the time where you'll have a journalist say, well, I got to get both sides of this issue. But both sides may not be equal. There may be facts on one side and not on the other. And you don't have to treat those as both equal. Global warming is the classic example where journalists are finally coming to terms with the idea that there's actual science on this issue and that you need to pay attention to that science and that you can't allow a weatherman to go up against a climate change expert.
The idea of journalism as having kind of a scoreboard, you know, how many experts on this side do we have versus how many experts on the other side that we have.
Right. That's not important anymore. In fact, it's actually harmful. Whereas when you only had a few number of voices that could access the marketplace of ideas, it was much more important to get those minority voices in. But now sometimes the minority voices can be inappropriately amplified, so much so that the audience is confused about what the real facts are.
I wonder also if because there are so many more outlets than there once were, so many more people who think of themselves as journalists, are the ethics of how we work within the industry, how we treat each other as journalists, a greater part of the equation than they once were?
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're trying to describe is the media ecosystem. And it used to be that you had this this foundation of journalists who created the original content. And newspapers were at the very core of that foundation. So in cities all across the country, you had small and medium-sized newspapers that set the agenda of the topics of the day for the community. And radio and television stations tended to riff off the newspapers. Not always. Sometimes they sought their own stories, but often they reflected upon and amplified what the newspapers were already doing. And then you had these national organizations like the Associated Press and the New York Times and the broadcast television stations that sorted through all that local content and elevated some of it to national conversation. That's not what happens anymore. Now you have a smaller number of people creating original content, and you have even more people and organizations creating opinion based on that original content, and sometimes not based on that original content at all, sometimes just creating opinion. So we have a lot more opinion and commentary in the marketplace of ideas right now. We have fewer organizations and fewer individuals that are devoted to identifying and surfacing new facts and new information.
Do you get calls from the right people, do you think, as an ethics expert? I mean, are you really in a position where the kinds of journalists you work with are most of the way there simply because they're actually thinking in terms of ethics?
Well, I get a lot of calls. So But I certainly – my phone doesn't ring all day. If the right people were calling me for advice, I wouldn't be able to handle it because every decision that a journalist makes is an ethical decision. It has ethical implications. And for the most part, I think that journalists and journalism organizations have a pretty good understanding of what their mission is and how they serve that mission in an ethical way. However, I think that – most news organizations are operating on a much faster clip than they used to. And so they occasionally forget to think about things because they're moving so fast. And the business pressures are challenging news organizations to find new sources of revenue. And sometimes they don't think all the way through it. You know, so we had an example. Native advertising is a big, big news source of revenue. And this is where a news organization creates content that looks and smells and acts like it's regular content, but it's somehow branded sponsored content or native advertising. The Atlantic did this with a piece for the Church of Scientology, and the audience went nuts because they felt like it wasn't transparent enough, and that particular topic was so controversial that they didn't appreciate the Atlantic, which is a very good journalistic organization, allowing an advertiser to create something that felt like a dupe. It felt like they were tricking the audience. So that's one example. And I think that news organizations are dealing with big and small pressures like that every single day. And for the most part, they don't have to call me. They don't have to call an ethics expert. But what they do have to do is stop and ask questions about what they're doing and how that reflects their core set of values.
Well, and to use that Atlantic example here, is this a question of simply the audience determining what feels right to them ethically? I mean, that the Atlantic might have been legally right and right from a business model, but if its audience didn't think it was ethical, it wasn't ethical?
Well, if the audience feels deceived or tricked, then you have failed to uphold your first principle, which is to tell the truth. Now, you may not have done that intentionally, but if the outcome – ethics has to be practical. It can't just be theoretical. So if the outcome is that people in the audience were deceived into believing even for a second that this was a real piece of journalism from the Atlantic, then all the other questions are not necessarily important to consider, because the outcome is what matters.
Well, and as you said, this is not a case where ethics are created in this ivory tower and are policed by some absolute authority. Do you think – is it a good thing that we as consumers of media are the ultimate police of ethical considerations in what we consume?
Well, it's a very democratic thing, right? I mean, we – live in a country that has a First Amendment that guarantees the right to a free press. And what that really means is that you can publish any idea at all into the marketplace of ideas, and your right to do that is guaranteed. So we have remedies for when that becomes harmful in the civil courts, and we have very few restrictions when publishing something can cause great harm to society, like shouting fire in a theater or something like that. But for the most part, we live in this world that allows that. And the benefits of that, the democratic benefits of that, I believe far outweigh all of the harmful manifestations that we are experiencing now. And you have to remember that amendment was written at a time when the press was crazy irresponsible. I mean, they were publishing things that were patently false and biased and carrying hidden political agendas. And so that speech was meant to be protected. Bad speech is as protected as good speech. And so that's the world that we live in. Now, if we really want democracy to thrive, that means that we – because if you go back to – consumers are also creators of content, that means that all of us citizens now have some sort of responsibility to develop a set of news literacy skills and to be responsible in what we publish and what we distribute. So that means, you know, the crazy stuff you pass along on your Facebook page or the crazy emails that you send along. You have the same obligation that the professional journalist has to be responsible with that information.
Even if we don't think right off the bat what we're doing is journalism, we actually are committing acts of journalism.
Absolutely. And an act of journalism, it's really hard to define who is a journalist these days. In fact, I can't do it. I've tried and I can't do it. I can tell you who gets a paycheck for doing journalism, but I can't tell you who a journalist is. And that's because sometimes we create content that acts as journalism. And by acting as journalism, what I mean is the information allows others to fulfill their civic duties, to understand their communities, to understand an issue, or to carry out their democratic obligations.
Even if we don't necessarily think of what we're doing as journalism, other people are treating it that way. And so this is something that ought to be on our minds when we post something to YouTube.
Right, right. And I mean, the other thing is that we actually have developed a pretty good sorting system right now. I once posted a picture of an alligator, right? So I live in Florida and I posted a picture of an alligator that I believed to be a 28-foot alligator. And that was the story that I posted underneath it. And it was a matter of seconds before the people on my Facebook page pointed out that that was undoubtedly fake. And they linked to the Snopes site that examined the photo and verified that it was fake. And then they pointed out to me that, like, alligators only get to be 15 feet tops, you know, that 28 feet was a little ridiculous and I maybe was spending too much time at Disney World. So I don't think we have to bear all this responsibility by ourselves, although it's important to keep these duties and obligations in mind. But we have each other to help us out. And that's actually what happens in newsrooms, right? Like you don't expect one person to bear the entire burden of telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's a communal effort. And so we do need to think about this both individually and as a community.
If only we could send our Facebook posts through a group of fact checkers before they went up.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is you can, but it's after they go up.
Kelly McBride, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Kelly McBride is a senior faculty member in ethics, reporting, and writing at the Poynter Institute in Florida. She's also co-editor of the recent book, The New Ethics of Journalism, Principles for the 21st Century. She spoke with Mitch Tyke at the end of February while she was in Milwaukee to give the Berlai Media Ethics Lecture at Marquette University. Coming up after a break, we'll talk movies with contributor Dave Lerson, so stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. For longtime Wes Anderson fans, the Grand Budapest Hotel comes as no surprise. It's the latest of his offbeat films, and by art house standards, it is a runaway hit. For those who don't know Anderson's work, this might be the movie that makes them fans. Lake Effect contributor Dave Lerson is the arts and entertainment editor for The Shepherd Express, and he tells Dan Harmon what makes Anderson's films so distinctive.
One writer made a profound remark, I think, that comparing his films to fairy tales, contemporary fairy tales, in the sense that it's creating a distinctive, maybe more colorful world than the reality we're in, where mildly, at least, incredible things can happen. It's a little off kilter. There sometimes is, as in any good fairy tale, the best fairy tale, some element of danger. There's a bad guy or an element of evil or potential evil or a problem of some kind that has to be solved. And you know, whether, you know, this is exactly correct or not, or whether, you know, moviegoers are conscious of that kind of idea, I think on an obvious level, when you go to a Wes Anderson film, you are usually entering a world that does seem a bit different than everyday reality, and not the same kind of world of Hollywood blockbusters, you know, where people, you know, fly and stop bullets and, you know, the typical kind of Hollywood product. He is anything but, you know, typical Hollywood product. I mean, there probably are very few predecessors in style to what Wes Anderson consistently has been doing. So you get the impression that you're entering this different space, kind of, you know, benign and cozy, but yet there are problems usually in his worlds that the characters who we tend to relate to or not, if you're not a fan. But I mean, usually I find that there are people in his movies that I can you know, find compelling, or I'm concerned enough about how their lives turn out that I get involved in the story as it progresses. So that may be a bit of a long-winded answer to a short question, but I think it is just that his movies are colorful. They are a bit amusing. They touch on things that are interesting. There's a nostalgia. You know, even if it's a nostalgia in the case of Grand Budapest Hotel for a time that very few people who are alive today experience, but it's something that many people have read about or are aware of. There's some connection to past realities that fills his movies.
Well, and if you're a fan, just his stories make you want to be there or be a part of them.
Yeah, I reviewed a book called Danubia recently, and it's basically a very amusing yet somewhat erudite book by a British writer on the whole Habsburg Empire of Central Europe and all the various things going on there. And I reviewed the book in terms of Grand Budapest Hotel. To be very simple about it, if you like the movie, you'll be interested in reading the book because the book really does give you some backdrop to what this is all about.
The book doesn't sound very fun or funky like the movie was.
Well, the movie is more fun. The book is actually fun because the writer has a very, very sharp British sense of humor and wit about him. So it's fun. Right. Funky, I think the funkiness comes from the reality of the history of that part of the world. There are things there that probably could be defined as funky in some way. But, yeah, I mean, if you want only 2 hours of this, I mean, the movie will do just fine. If you want to go deeper, you know, there's more there. And that is sometimes the case with Wes Anderson, that it's like a little colorful, brightly painted doorway, and you can admire the doorway, and that can be just fine. But if you open the doorway, you may find other things to explore.
Well, and even if you're not interested in that era or war history, if you will, the movie has a whole different element to it. There's a whole different story going on that might intrigue you even if you don't really care about that, you know, the Habsburg Empire and the collapse of Europe during World War II and one. I mean, it just there's a lot going on there for anyone.
Well, an awful lot going on, though. The plot is in part just, I think, there for the sake of having, you know, for moving things along. I mean, the piece of artwork, you know, that goes missing and becomes the focus of the search by the police and by fascists and by all kinds of other people. I mean, I think it's that's almost reminds me a little bit of Laurel and Hardy or something. I mean, there's an element there it's like the spring that sets the mechanics of it in motion. I mean, to me, that movie is more about the kinds of characters who could have lived in the kind of world that the movie shows us.
And this seems to be his most, and I've seen quite a few of his movies, not all of them, but elaborate. There obviously was he had more money to play with in this movie and a bigger cast and more elaborate sets and locations. Has he reached the big time, if you will? I mean, not only was this a sold-out audience, but, I mean, it's getting a lot of attention. So has he kind of achieved that status at this point?
Well, I think he did, you know, going into this movie. If this movie had been a major flop, that would have represented a terrible setback. But he went into this movie with big articles and all sorts of magazines and publications that don't normally feature directors of art house movies. The movie is doing very well. It's the art house hit of 2014 up to this point. And yes, I mean, I haven't really checked the statistics, but this movie was most likely considerably more expensive to do. It was filmed in Europe. He used an abandoned department store in a German town and rehabbed it into the hotel. Yes, there's a large cast of prestigious people, even if some of them had very small parts in the movie, but still you fly them out there, you pay them for their time. It all adds up. Yes, it's an expensive movie. I believe it's going to more than recover the cost. It'll turn a profit and position Wes Anderson for his next move. I think it puts him in a very good place.
And at the same time, you know, when I compare it to, for example, the Darjeeling Limited, there's still the same kind of feel to it. So I'm wondering what makes this one such a big hit. Is it just because he's had this kind of snowball effect of people, you know, just garnering more and more attention as he's produced more and more movies or directed more and more movies? Because it doesn't really feel different to me. He certainly does have a feel,
right,
to his movies.
Well, I think the snowball effect is just that he has been fortunate for whatever reason to have been enabled by an industry that's not very caring about creativity and works of art and so on. He has been allowed to make interesting, intriguing movies, very distinctive films, every few years, ever since he emerged to the general public with Rushmore in 1998. He had a movie before that time that gained him some indie credibility, but Rushmore was really the first time a lot of people saw.
Bottle Rocket was that first one, yeah.
Yeah, the first one was Bottle Rocket. Rushmore was the one that actually got into movie theaters more commonly. And since that time, the idea of Wes Anderson and Wes Anderson fandom, if you will, has grown steadily. I think that The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, a movie he did in 2005, I believe it was, or 2000, somewhere in the middle of the last decade, 2004. That was a movie that fewer people liked. It didn't do well at the box office. It was critically lambasted, generally speaking. But he recovered from that. And Darjeeling Limited was the next film he directed afterward. And he's just been building an audience. I mean, there is an audience out there waiting for Wes Anderson films. And Grand Budapest Hotel has probably expanded that quite a bit.
So how has he been able to do this? I mean, he's not a super wealthy person with a film background, or, you know, he didn't have connections in Hollywood or the film industry that I know of anyway. So is this really just a grassroots movement based on his work, or is there something else going on that has allowed him to do this?
Well, I don't really have an accurate answer to your question, but as an educated guess, he came about in the late 90s with Bottle Rocket at a time when the Hollywood industry was looking for, you know, indie credibility, the next Tarantino, the next whatever it was. And here was this quirky young guy named Wes Anderson from Austin, Texas. Maybe it's him. Maybe we'll give him a chance. And from there, you know, he earned enough critical accolades and made, you know, enough money on his movies that he got a second chance. And I think it just sort of built from there. He was fortunate, really, at the time that Bottle Rocket came out, that there was this attitude in Hollywood of looking for someone, maybe not exactly like Wes Anderson, because they couldn't have conceived of that exactly, but some unusual sort of young filmmaker with a different sensibility that could appeal to what they saw as this growing indie audience in America and elsewhere.
Is he going to become the next IT director as far as actors and actresses that want to be in his movies, not just to make money, but because they like what he does artistically?
I think he's almost there already. I mean, there are some people who've been in his films very consistently, Owen Wilson and Bill Murray and so on. But yeah, you know, he is in a sense like Woody Allen, that people would just love to be part of a Wes Anderson movie at this point. After spending 2 years, you know, wearing leotards and bodysuits and flying through the air or something, you can get off the set of that blockbuster and do something that has a great deal of respect and admiration in totally different areas of our culture. Yeah, you know, this kind of thing appeals to a great many actors who nowadays, I think more than in the past maybe, have a real sense they don't want to be typecast as one thing or another. I don't want to be typecast as a superhero or as a detective or as a murderer or as an art house intellectual or whatever it is. I want to be able to do all of these things if possible. And Wes Anderson gives you a very respectable avenue in one area of filmmaking.
And, you know, that reminds me of something that I thought about his movies, which are that he does this without any gratuitous violence. I mean, there's violence in his movies, but there isn't any, it's not overtly sexual, it's not overtly violent. I'm thinking about the movies I've seen, maybe some of them are, but as far as I know, he does what he does without going in that direction.
Right. I mean, the violence and sexuality of Grand Budapest Hotel is, you know, done with a feather's touch. I mean, in a way, I mean, there are killings in this movie, and there's obviously sex going on in this movie too, but it's not in your face. It's not torture porn or anything. You know, it doesn't fall into these very grim genres that have attracted audiences. You know, the thing is that Wes Anderson, you can't put him into a genre exactly because his films are distinctive. You know, he's, oh, yeah, Wes Anderson, he's a fill-in-the-blank. Well, what is he exactly? There isn't a label for what he does. I think that's a great thing, and I suspect that many other people find that refreshing also.
Is he going to be under pressure now to do bigger and better, or do you is Hollywood going to get a taste of him and want more from him, or give him money, or give him a blank slate, or do you think he's going to try to stay small-ish?
Well, I'm going to again make an educated guess that he would like to build cautiously off of the success of Grand Budapest Hotel. That he would probably make a great mistake if suddenly he decided to do the next Batman movie or something of this kind. I have a feeling that doesn't interest him. He may very well be offered things like this. I mean, that has happened in the last couple of decades in Hollywood, and some people have gone for the bait with that. I think that he would like to make the next film, according to his own vision. Maybe he'll have more money to spend. He can, film it in China or in somewhere in South America, wherever he may want to put it. And he certainly won't have any problem attracting the best cast available for him. And, I see him as being basically on this gradual ascent career-wise, and the success of this movie will keep him going on that trajectory.
And I ask that question mainly, like, for example, Gus Van Sant reminds me of this, the same career trajectory. You know, he had these quite a few sort of underground hits, and then he had one big movie, which, you know, Hollywood scale movie, and then he just kind of decided that wasn't for him. He produced more of what he wanted to produce.
Yeah, Gus Van Sant has sort of, you know, toyed with the Hollywood type movie. I think he's done more than one of those. I had to think back for a minute about that. But then he goes back to doing very personal movies that have focused audiences. I think that Wes Anderson's movies have a larger audience than the Gus Van Sant's personal movies because they are less threatening. They are more generally entertaining in some way. You don't really have to be part of any particular subculture, I think, to relate to Wes Anderson's films, whereas with some of Gus Van Sant's films, I think that's helpful, you know, to be part of the skate punk culture or to be a Kurt Cobain fan or to be any number of other things that he's done interesting movies on. But with Wes Anderson, I don't think you need that. With Grand Budapest Hotel, you don't need to be an expert on early 20th century European history to appreciate the movie. If you are, it just makes it even more interesting to you. But if not, it still is there as this compelling artifact that draws you into it.
Okay. Thanks again for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Lurson is the arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express and the author of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke with Dan Harmon about the career of director Wes Anderson.
We'll take one last break and then return with a conversation with award-winning writer Scott Russell Sanders. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Glad to have you with us. Writer Scott Russell Sanders is loved by many for novels and essays, many of which carry a natural theme. But while the environment does play a significant, even vital role in his books, such as A Conservationist Manifesto and his latest, Divine Animal, it's not the only issue that he writes about. Sanders' work spans 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, although, as we'll hear, nonfiction isn't a term he especially likes. He's told his own coming-of-age story, he's examined how geography influences culture, and is currently at work on a project exploring the meaning of wealth. Along the way, he's collected numerous awards for his writing and also appointments such as the 2014 Lois and Willard Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College, which came to an end in early March. It's the second time he's held that post. He also spoke at Milwaukee's Urban Ecology Center in March, and he joined Mitch Tyke in the studio then. Sanders said that the most important things his students can learn is that writing is a way of thinking and of discovery.
Often in school, as we're growing up, writing is presented to us as a way of packaging knowledge that's already known and then delivering it in a nice, neat fashion to the teacher. You're not really making any discoveries. But the kind of writing I enjoy reading and the kind of writing I encourage my students to do is writing where you're actually discovering things about your experience, about the world, about language, about reality. And so that's the single most important lesson or insight that I would hope they would go away with.
Do you find it's difficult to turn off that need to know exactly where you're going with something and what you're going to reveal, you know, before you set out on the writing journey?
It took me quite a while. And I understand that students might feel very insecure if they're launching out on an inquiry and really don't know where it's going to end up. Obviously, they always have a chance to revise. So once you've ended up somewhere, you can then revise the whole piece to prepare for where you've landed. But it requires an openness to insight, an openness to exploration that we tend not to be taught when we're coming up through school. Again, we tend to be taught in a way where you're finding the certain things, the known things, and you're simply delivering them rather than discovering them.
It's interesting. There is a phenomenon in radio programs like this called the pre-interview that many shows follow, where there's a producer who will call an interview subject and essentially interview that person before the host interviews that person, so that there are no surprises once the interview actually takes place.
There is a major American hotel chain, I won't name the brand, which for some years ran a television advertisement in which a couple traveling, first of all, they come into a lobby where they're strange. People are dressed in strange clothes and strange sounds and creatures, and they decide to leave. And then they go to this chain hotel, and the clerk welcomes them, and the ad says, "No surprises." In other words, this is a place where you know everything before you come. But of course, we don't learn anything if we know everything before we start. We only learn by being open to new discoveries. I've actually had those pre-interview interviews, and so I know what you're talking about. And I always find the actual interview much less interesting if it feels more canned than one where I and the interviewer are really exploring together.
There's this whole field that, you know, maybe I missed it when I was in school, but it seems like maybe the label is a recent development, the idea of so-called creative nonfiction. What are your feelings about that label?
I dislike the label intensely, and you would not have encountered it when you were in school because it's a relatively new term. it has two problems with it. The first is the word creative, and the second word is the word nonfiction. The problem with the word creative is it implies that there are other kinds of writing and other kinds of thought, for that matter, that are not creative. Well, I happen to love science, and my wife's a scientist, my daughter's a scientist, and my undergraduate studies were in science. And science is tremendously creative. Good history requires creative intelligence. A good biography does as well. So I don't distinguish between creative writing and writing that's somehow not creative. So that's the first problem. The bigger problem, however, is nonfiction. That's a term that was coined in the 19th century by librarians to divide their collection between novels and stories on the one hand, and on the other hand, sermons and histories and very serious books. Well, calling all those kinds of writing nonfiction is like saying food is divided up between cheese and non-cheese, right? Well, that doesn't help you very much, so that spaghetti is non-cheese and so is pork and so is chocolate, and they're all non-cheese, but that doesn't really tell you anything interesting. So I think the term creative nonfiction is an unfortunate one. I also feel we're stuck with it. So my workshop is in the writing. I have two different ways of describing it. One is personal essays and one is personal narratives. And the personal is an important word. It's to distinguish it from scholarship and journalism. And narrative means storytelling. But this is storytelling where the stories you're telling derive directly from your own experience. You're not making them up, in other words.
Do you think – are we too quick to put things that seem objectively scientific in that box? I guess the question I'm working towards is you said you yourself studied science at first in school. Your wife is a scientist. Your daughter is a scientist. Are we too quick to remove the creativity from science and separate things like science and math from the humanities?
Oh, definitely. My wife, when she would come home from the lab and I would ask her how the experiment was going, she'd say, well, we're getting wonderful data, but we don't have a story yet. And this wasn't unique to her. This is a term that scientists frequently use. And by story, she means, okay, we have these pieces of evidence that we've gathered from our experiment. But the story essentially is the narrative which connects them. And that's what a scientific hypothesis is. And that requires creativity. All of the great scientists have testified to this. Einstein and Galileo and Newton and so forth have talked about the role that imagination plays in science. It's not just a machine where you turn the crank enough times and then out comes some scientific theory. You gather evidence, but then you have to see a pattern, and that requires imagination. So I see good science as being absolutely as creative an endeavor as composing music or painting paintings or writing poetry.
How did you discover the personal essay?
I discovered it as a confirmed fiction writer. All of my early writing for about 15 years was short stories and novels, and I still write fiction. My most recent book is a novel. But when I became a father and spent lots of time with our two young children, I wanted to write about those experiences I was having with them, but I didn't want to fictionalize them. And so I started writing what I thought of simply as true stories. This is something I did yesterday with my son. This is something I did today with my daughter. And those true stories, it turned out, were essays. And I didn't even know they were essays until magazines started publishing them and calling them essays. And I came to write more and more of that personal essay kind of writing as a way of exploring my own experience.
Why didn't you want to fictionalize them?
Well, there are two reasons that I didn't want to fictionalize my experiences with my children, with young children. First of all, it's very difficult to treat children in fiction without sentimentalizing them. And second of all, it would seem to distort or take away from the actual veracity of the experience that I have with my children and now with my grandchildren. So I think there are experiences that lend themselves to fictionalizing, where free invention makes sense. And then there are experiences where you have a respect for the actual experience and you don't want to alter it in the way that fiction would require. So as I say, today I write both. I write fiction and I write essays. And I almost always know at the outset clearly and distinctly which kind of thing I'm writing.
many of your essays and much of your fiction has an environmental feel to it. Did you consider yourself an environmental writer when you first began writing?
I didn't, no. But I grew up in the country in Ohio, rural Ohio, spent as much time as I could outdoors. And so I've always loved nature. I thought of it as nature. I always loved trees and creeks and rocks and so forth. And so my writing has always been filled with references to the natural world. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s, really. I'm now 68, so it's been a while. But it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I began to see that nature, what we call nature, is endangered. The things that I love, the things that I find beautiful and exciting and that have nourished me all my life are endangered. And because nature's endangered, we're endangered. So that meant in the jargon of our culture that I'm an environmentalist. So I didn't set out to become an environmentalist. It was a way of, it was a consequence of following my fascination with and love of the natural world. What I call myself now, people say, are you a nature writer? And I say, actually, I'm an earth writer. That is, I'm aware of living on a planet alongside about 7 billion of my own species and millions of other species, and depending for everything that I eat and drink and wear and use in my daily life, as do we all, on the earth. So I'm intensely aware of belonging to the natural world.
It seems as though you were coming into your own in this career at a time when maybe the conservation movement was also coming into its own, the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts, and not long before the first Earth Day. How did the place of the movement in the public eye perhaps affect the writer you were becoming?
Oh, it had a very big effect. I was deeply influenced by several major social movements in the 1960s, because that's when I came of age. I graduated from high school in 1963. I graduated from college in 1967. I finished a PhD in English in 1971. So basically the decade of the 1960s was the decade in which I formed most of my adult concerns and many of my values. And the nascent environmental movement of the 1960s was a major part of that. So was the civil rights movement. So was the women's movement. So was the anti-war movement. So those were the big social public movements that were convulsing our culture in the 1960s and that had a profound influence on me. Listeners today may find it, especially younger listeners, may find it hard to believe that in the 1960s, there was bipartisan support for the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, the Environmental Protection Agency Act. There was a sense that we need to take care of our shared world, the natural world on which we depend. Unfortunately, that consensus has been lost in most of our state legislatures and definitely in the U.S. Congress.
In the author's note from your most recent novel, you actually quote Aldo Leopold that one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. You use the quote to point out that you actually have not been alone in your work. But at the same time, it must be easy to feel that way when you talk about these circumstances that you're just describing.
First of all, let me just say that Aldo Leopold is one of my great, great heroes. I know his work very well. I spent last weekend actually at the Leopold Center outside Baraboo doing some work for them. And I think he should be one of the people that people of Wisconsin should be most proud of, because he spent all of his most influential years here in this state. Yes, that quote is very apt, I think, for anyone who educates himself or herself about the state of the earth. He said, an ecological education makes you aware of all the damage we've done, the wounds. Where I differ, of course, is not feeling alone in that recognition. Certainly, it's only a minority of Americans that are paying much attention to the damage that we're doing to the planet and to other species. But that's still a lot of people. And the people that I'm closest to intellectually and artistically are people who share that awareness that Leopold was trying to make more widely available.
As you described it just a moment ago, there was a time not really all that long ago when a lot of this was really a bipartisan issue, that this was there was great consensus across party and ideological lines. Do you think as a society did we elect to hit the snooze bar?
That's part of it. I think Americans have become complacent in many, many ways. But I think the other thing that happened was that corporate America, the people who don't want regulations, they don't want the Endangered Species Act, they don't want the Clean Air, Clean Water, et cetera, they don't want the Environment Protection Agency regulating CO2 emissions, that corporate America, not all corporations, but the ones that, for example, the fossil fuel industry, have relentlessly underwritten legislative careers so that we now have legislatures, again, in the states and certainly in the U.S. Congress, where a very significant proportion, maybe even the majority of the members, are basically working for corporations. Now, that may sound radical, but it seems to me a patent truth. So what happened in the 60s was that this legislation came through rapidly. It came through when corporations, although they opposed them, the chemical industry, for example, opposed the Clean Water Act from the beginning. They opposed the restrictions on the use of DDT from the beginning and tried to smear Rachel Carson for her warnings. They certainly made efforts to prevent such legislation from being passed. But at the time, we had a larger percentage of the people in elective office who had not been elected by corporations. And now I think, unfortunately, the majority of people, at least at the national level and in many state legislatures, are basically working for corporations, not for the American people, or let alone for the earth.
Scott Russell Sanders, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's been a pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Russell Sanders just finished a term as the Mackey Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at Beloit College. He taught from 1971 to 2009 at Indiana University, where he's now a Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English. His latest novel is Divine Animal. It's currently available for free as an ebook. There's a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Mitch Tyke first spoke with Sanders in March. And with that, we'll close another week's worth of Lake Effects. Our show is produced by Mitch Tyke, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce. We get production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, web support from Michelle Matanowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. And I'm Bonnie North. Have a great weekend, and thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us also tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend and for our regular show beginning at 10 a.m. on Monday morning. It's all on listener support at 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh Air is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.